Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Stan Berman, and I represent the California parties. I'll be sharing my time today with Mr. Kevin McEwen, who will be addressing the issue of refunds for purchases by the State of California. As a preliminary matter, I want to explain the California parties and who we are. It's somewhat strange or unusual that the state's largest utilities, its regulators, and its law enforcement agencies would be working together with an attorney for one of the state's utilities representing the collective group. But there's a reason for that. It's because it's the ratepayers of the state's largest utilities, the ratepayers of California, that paid the $8 to $10 billion in overcharges. That's billions with a B in overcharges resulting from the market manipulation and other activities that are the subject of this case. Put another way, when I complain about the $6 billion or so in overcharges that have not been recovered in this case, I'm referring to $6 billion or so dollars that have been paid by ratepayers of California and will not be paid back to ratepayers of California unless this court reverses FERC. Your Honor, the California party's petition raises three main issues. Issue one is what relates to the fact that the overcharges started May 1st, 2000. The market manipulation and other and exercises of market power that led to the overcharges started, at least on a massive scale, May 1st, 2000. The relief should start May 1st, 2000. The issue of whether or not there should be relief for the period May 1st, 2000 through October 1st, 2000, which I'll sometimes call the summer 2000 issue, is worth billions of dollars to the ratepayers of California. Issue number two relates to the fact that in January 2001, the state of California took over power purchasing in the state, and the sales directly to the state of California were excluded from mitigation. That issue, which will be addressed by my colleague, Mr. McEwen, is also worth billions of dollars to ratepayers in California. The third issue relates to certain transactions that have been arbitrarily excluded from mitigation. These are the multi-day and exchange transactions, or in-kind transactions, that meet all of the Commission's other criteria for relief in terms of the time that they incurred, that they occurred, the parties that were involved, the markets that were involved, but have been arbitrarily excluded from relief. Those transactions and denial of relief for those transactions is worth hundreds of millions of dollars, a very large amount, but in the context of this case, chicken feed. I'm not going to further address the issue of multi-day and exchange transactions in this argument, and we'll focus on the summer 2000 unless Your Honors have questions about the multi-day and exchange transactions.
I think it's been adequately briefed.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, turning now to the summer of 2000, I should say that FERC's briefs, FERC's orders, and the briefs of the various parties in the case all suffer from a fundamental issue concerning a fundamental confusion concerning the statutory basis for the relief that we're seeking in the summer 2000. I think that this may flow in part from the fact that San Diego Gas and Electric Company, when it filed its original complaint, filed it pursuant to the Commission's rule that allows complaints to be filed. That rule, contained in the Commission's Rules of Practice and Procedure at 18 CFR Part 385, is entitled Rule 206. San Diego Gas and Electric's complaint never cited to or referred to Section 206 of the Federal Power Act or any statutory basis. It didn't limit itself in that way. It was a Rule 206 complaint, and a complaint based on any statutory basis can be filed at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under Rule 206 of the Commission's Rules of Practice and Procedure. We hear over and over and over again in the briefs that have been filed, this is the Section 206 case, and there are rules that apply to Section 206 cases, including the refund effective date. Well, when it comes to the summer 2000, that period occurs prior to the refund effective date. We are not seeking an earlier refund effective date. We are not seeking to have Section 206 of the Federal Power Act apply to the summer of 2000. Because the complaint was brought under a variety of statutory bases, they included Section 206, which allows changes in the rate that's on file, and those changes can go into effect from the refund effective date. But it was also brought under Sections 205 and 309 of the Federal Power Act. And under 205 and 309 of the Federal Power Act, a party can seek enforcement of the existing just and reasonable filed rate. And if the existing just and reasonable filed rate has not been complied with, you can obtain retroactive refunds as far back as they go to enforce the just and reasonable filed rate. More or less the only reason that's been asserted by FERC, once you cut through the statutory hodgepodge or the statutory confusion about 206 versus 205, the only reason that's left for not having the issue of summer 2000 relief addressed here is the argument that we should be obtaining the relief in the several dozen investigatory and enforcement proceedings that FERC has instituted, what we call the splinter proceedings. There are three problems with the splinter proceedings. Problem number one, the splinter proceedings are inconsistent with the court's orders in this case as well as the Federal Power Act. Problem number two, the relief that can be afforded in the splinter proceedings is inconsistent with the market structure because it does not allow for or provide for market-wide relief, even though there was a market-wide price setting. Issue number three, the manner in which the splinter proceedings have been conducted violates due process and has been used to effectuate a shell game in which we've been told we can't obtain our relief here because we should obtain our relief elsewhere, and we're told elsewhere that we can't obtain our relief there because we should obtain our relief here. I'll address each of those three issues in turn.
Would you go back to the issue of Rule 206 versus Sections 205 and 206? Just so I understand your position, is your position that because the complaint was not filed with reference to any specific statutory remedy, that all available statutory remedies are available?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that when the complaint was filed, San Diego Gas and Electric, frankly, did not want to limit itself in what the basis was for the relief it was seeking. It just wanted the relief. And so it cited to the Commission's rule without any cite to the statute. In our pleadings throughout this case, including pleadings that were filed in the 2000 period, in August 2000 and November 2000, we've been citing to the other statutory provisions, including Sections 205 and 309, as a basis for relief. So we've made it clear to the Commission from way back that we were seeking relief both after the refund effective date and prior to the refund effective date, but that relief that we're seeking is not limited to just Section 206.
Going back then to the Commission's position, the Commission basically has the remedies under 206, plus it has what you have termed the splinter proceedings, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
If we're to determine whether that configuration of the remedy scheme is an abuse of discretion, what's the standard against which we benchmark it? In other words, don't they have a fairly wide swath in determining how to configure the remedy proceeding?
Your Honor, they do have a broad discretion in general in how they configure the proceeding, but as I was saying when I enumerated my three reasons, there are reasons why the splinter proceedings don't work here. Reason number one is whether it's consistent with this court's orders.
Well, let's say that it is, because that court order was about as neutral and non-directive as possible, other than it didn't say what they had to do. It simply left open the options, it seems to me. So if that weren't a basis, well, let me just step back. You're saying the reason that it's an abuse is because the splinter proceedings, in your view, don't give an effective remedy.
Your Honor, they don't give an effective remedy. Turning to the Turning to the shell game argument, which is one of the reasons they don't give an effective remedy, those proceedings have been conducted in general in a non-public fashion, and where they have not been conducted, and those few that have been theoretically public, we've been told that we have no right to seek expansion of the extremely narrow grounds that have been set for consideration, and with the sole exception, really, of the claim against Enron, which they've been too embarrassed to settle, they have settled through sham settlements or resolved through dismissals or other means, essentially all of the splinter proceedings that are out there.
Okay, so let's just stop there. From our perspective as an appellate court, how would we evaluate what you just said? In other words, I'm sure that FERC would take issue with what you might term as sham settlements. And we don't know one way or the other in this proceeding whether they were or not. How would we determine whether or not that posture was arbitrary and capricious? Would we have to go in and look at each of the 309 proceedings?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are several issues. One is that there are reasons not to confuse the proceedings, and I'd like to use what I hope is a simple analogy. Someone breaks into a house. After they break, and they hurt some of the people inside, the state may institute prosecutions of the crook who entered in the house. The state may have absolute discretion. Absolute as to whether it decides to prosecute the crook, and if they decide to prosecute the crook, the state may have absolute discretion to settle with the crook on a lesser charge, even if based on frivolous reasons such as administrative concerns that may seem frivolous to the parties involved. Whether or not the state does that, the victims of the criminal have a right to pursue a civil lawsuit against the crook. And what the state did in the prosecutions, where it has absolute discretion, are irrelevant to the rights of the victims to pursue their civil lawsuit. And what's happened here is that we've seen some conflating of the civil lawsuit, which is essentially this case, although it's before FERC, and the prosecutions, where FERC indeed has broad discretion to conduct its affairs, and where it's decided to essentially dismiss most of the claims except those against Enron.
I'll take your house analogy. The case reminds me a little when you talk about the house of Goldilocks. She breaks in, and she said, this bed is too little. So that's your argument. These proceedings are too narrow. And then she goes to another bed and says, this one's too big. And so that's the next round, which is it's too broad. And then FERC, or Goldilocks, says, no, it's just right. what I'm trying to figure out is how do we determine if it's just right? In other words, what I'm trying to understand from your perspective is the legal mistake that they made, or some other mistake that FERC made that would rise to the level of an abuse of discretion? If you could help me through that analysis.
Among their legal mistakes are one, that the relief they provide is inadequate because it's not market-wide. And given the structure of this market in which prices are set market-wide, to look at things individually does not give market-wide relief. They've evaded the fact that there's pervasive misconduct in every hour during the period. And when there's misconduct by multiple parties during an hour, that affects the prices paid to everyone. And to examine and scrutinize only what's going on with one party rather than to consider market-wide relief is insufficient.
Okay, and why is that legally insufficient? It doesn't give a whole remedy, and is there a statutory duty to provide a whole remedy?
Your Honor, in general, in the civil lawsuit, instead of the prosecution,
right.
In the civil lawsuit,
there
is an obligation for FERC in general to provide a remedy. We've seen the case law on that, and the case law includes not only your September Lockyer decision, but, say, the Consolidated Edison versus FERC decision from September 2003. In the Consolidated Edison versus FERC decision, the court explained that FERC has a general policy of providing full relief if there's a tariff violation, and it has to provide a reasoned basis to explain that it's not providing full relief. And in the remand order, the New York ISO remand order that was issued March 4, 2005, that we submitted to the court a few days ago, FERC took the Consolidated Edison case, looked at the other precedent that's out there, and explained what guides it in deciding whether it will follow its general policy of providing full relief if there's a tariff violation. And the answer was it will look at the principles of equity, citing to the Town of Concord case, and it will look at its statutory duty to ensure just and reasonable rates. Here, the principles of equity and the statutory duty to provide just and reasonable rates cry out for providing full relief for the billions of dollars of overcharges we sustained. This is not like the Town of Concord case, where there was a hyper-technical issue. That is, in the Town of Concord case, a FERC rule that said you shouldn't spell, said that you couldn't collect the charge unless you separately spelled it out. There was no question that the seller had actually incurred the cost, or that the buyer would have had to pay the cost if it had been separately spelled out. It just hadn't been separately spelled out. And FERC and then the court said, well, equity doesn't have a problem here. Equity and just and reasonable principles don't demand that the customer in that case get paid. Here, equity and just and reasonable principles demand that we get paid. They also demand that we get a forum somewhere, and it's not good enough for them to say in the other cases that to not even hear our claim. There might be a different story if we could go to the other cases and raise our claim. If we could participate, then if they were not doing it right, we could raise that issue to you and say they're not doing it right, and you could consider that. But they don't say that they're not doing it right.
Is that an option still?
Your Honor, I guess what I'd say on that is a good example of that. And my time is – can I finish this question, Your Honor? A good example of this situation is in a proceeding that was argued December 8, 2004, before another panel of this court. That's the PG&E versus FERC case concerning a settlement, a sham settlement, of one of these splinter proceedings. And what happened in that case is that it involved a particular seller, Reliant, and FERC, and it related to their conduct over the entire crisis period from early 2000 throughout, including some serious misconduct in June 2000. And FERC agreed to settle with that seller, and we came in and said, your settlement is not nearly enough. And what FERC said is, we're not going to let you get involved. You have no right to participate in this proceeding. And we said, well, we have to have a right to participate somewhere. And what they said to us was, no, your rights, if any, will be to pursue relief in this case.
But what if hypothetically FERC were wrong, and what if in that case it were ruled you could come in? How would that affect your argument here?
Well, Your Honor, if we could come in that case, I'm sure that we would manage to get more relief there, and so we would be better off. That's for sure. But it would not provide all the relief we need because, for one thing, it would not provide market-wide relief and would not address the fact that numerous market participants, in addition to Reliant, were manipulating these markets. We know that Reliant was manipulating the markets. We know that Enron was manipulating the markets, and there have been FERC findings about Enron's manipulation of the markets. We know that PowerX was doing the same things that Enron was doing, the same things that have led to Enron people entering into criminal plea agreements. We know that lots of parties were manipulating the markets, and to not be able to present them in one place, this place, and seek and obtain relief in this place, given the market structure where prices are set market-wide, where what one party is doing affects the prices that all the other parties are doing, does not allow us to get our full relief. And that's what we deserve. We deserve our full relief. If we paid an extra $3 billion for the summer of 2000 over what a competitive market would have yielded, then we deserve to get our $3 billion back and not a mere fraction, which is what FERC has settled for in its various settlements.
Thank you, counsel. No relation.
No relation. You forgot the W in your last name.
May it please the court. My name is Kevin McEwen. I'm appearing today on behalf of the people of the state of California and also the California Parties Group. I'll address the issue of FERC's refusal to grant refunds on sales to the state. In our briefs, we short-form that as the CERS, or CERS, issue. CERS is the California Energy Resource Scheduling Division of the California Department of Water Resources, which is the state agency that was forced to step in when the markets failed. CERS was the buyer of last resort, and it did what was necessary during the utter chaos of the crisis to keep the lights on. FERC's refusal to grant refunds on sales to CERS will cost California consumers approximately $3.5 billion. If we don't get the money back from sellers, California consumers are going to be paying the bill for the next 20 years. What I'd like to do is take 2 minutes to talk about the facts that show why refusing to grant refunds on sales to CERS simply cannot be squared with FERC's statutory duty to protect consumers. The state was forced to create CERS in January of 2001. By that time, FERC had already put sellers and buyers on notice that rates in California wholesale markets were unjust and unreasonable and that refunds would be granted. So essentially, FERC was saying relief is on the way. That was in November and even earlier than November in 2000. Nobody had a crystal ball, of course, and so when San Diego Gas and Electric filed its complaint, it complained about the wholesale market as it knew it, which was the ISO and PX markets. And FERC gave notice about those markets. And so the focus was on the ISO and PX.
FERC's basic argument against that is saying, well, you should have filed a separate complaint on the CERS issues because it wasn't embraced in the San Diego complaint. What's your response to that?
Your Honor, we simply had no reason to believe that the facts that I'm talking about, I think, support this. We had no reason to believe that FERC would essentially revoke the refund protection that it had already granted for the ISO and PX markets. This was the place where almost all of the wholesale power in California was being exchanged. And FERC said in November and earlier that refunds would be granted because the prices were so outrageous and because there was market power that FERC had seen. And then as the crisis got worse, CERS had to be created. And CERS stepped into the role of the PX and CERS stepped into the role of the ISO.
Was CERS one of the parties that filed a motion for clarification as to what is the scope of the proceeding?
Your Honor, the EOB representing the Electricity Oversight Board, that is, representing the consumers, filed a motion with FERC in March. Essentially, the EOB's motion was to have a belt and suspenders approach. Our view was everybody should have known that when CERS had to be created, the market melted down, that the same refund protection that had already been extended for this very market would also apply to sales to the state.
Let me go back to Judge Thomas's question. In the spirit of belt and suspenders, in addition to having a motion for clarification, I'm still somewhat perplexed as to why separate Section 2056 actions weren't filed as a precautionary matter, because then we wouldn't be arguing about it now as to whether it's in or out.
Well, I think sorry.
Why is there some procedural trick? I'm trying to understand why, as a matter of precaution, it wouldn't have just been filed and then asked to consolidate or to say, well, it's already in there and it's superfluous.
Your Honor, there are actually two procedural tricks, if you will. The first is, and they're in FERC's bag, not our bag. The first is that had we filed such a complaint, we'd have immediately lost 2 months of sales. That would have been about $2 billion worth of purchases.
Simply because you would have been 2 months down the road.
Exactly. The earliest possible date that we would have had a refund effective date, had we filed when CERS was created, would have been sometime in mid-March of 2001.
But why wouldn't you have filed and said, look, we really think we're in the beginning, the original proceeding, but just in case you think we're not, at least we're in a separate proceeding.
Your Honor, again,
the possibility is you could be left with neither of the above.
In other words, that's a tactical choice, and I understand why you might do that. But on the other hand, you risked an all-or-nothing approach to this, the whole CSRS fund. You would have lost 2 months, maybe, by filing a second suit, and maybe some leverage. But you certainly could have filed a second suit. There's no doubt about that.
Well, Your Honor, again,
complaint, I should say.
The other trick in FERC's bag, FERC has said in retrospect that these transactions are all bilaterals. Bilateral contracts between CSRS and individual sellers. And so the next trick in FERC's bag would be to say, okay, you can file your complaint, and we'll have a refund effective date that is 2 months down the road, so you won't get refunds for that period. In this case, that would have lost us about $1 billion or more. The analysis that we're going to apply is that because this is a bilateral contract, very high standard of reforming the contract applies, the Mobile Sierra standard, and FERC would then have denied us relief in the same way that it denied us relief on the long-term contracts that CSRS also entered into, which are totally separate from the relief that we're asking for here. But CSRS also did file a complaint on those long-term contracts, and FERC denied it for the very reason I'm saying, and that's on appeal before this Court as well. The case was argued back in December.
That answer. Are you saying that you didn't file separately because you feared separately issues would be raised that would prevent your claim from being granted?
Well, Your Honor, no. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, I guess the fundamental approach here, or the fundamental issue in my view, is how do you view CSRS's position? What is CSRS? And our position is that CSRS is an integral part of the very market that we're talking about here. This is not a situation in which we have a bilateral sale between a municipality and a private seller that happened to get caught up in this the high prices of this crisis. This is a situation in which CSRS was forced to step in and start purchasing power in an emergency situation to completely take the place of the PX.
Because sort of like a cover situation, in effect.
Exactly, Your Honor. And when CSRS came on the scene, the original expectation when CSRS came on the scene is that CSRS was going to be buying in the PX on behalf of the consumers because the IOUs couldn't pay the bills anymore because the prices had been so high for so long. And so that was the original expectation. Also, CSRS was going to be helping the ISO procure power for its grid balancing function because the ISO couldn't do that any longer because sellers wouldn't sell the ISO because the ISO wasn't creditworthy because the prices had been so high for so long. So each of these pieces related to the other. And so what CSRS did was step in, essentially become the PX. CSRS was the PX. CSRS was the only buyer in the California wholesale market after January. And so, and CSRS essentially became the only buyer for ISO power after January because the ISO, as soon as CSRS was created, refused to sell to, the sellers refused to sell to the ISO and insisted on selling to CSRS. So the other piece of this is that FERC is primarily responsible for having terminated the PX. And so CSRS comes on the scene, expects to be buying power in the PX, expects to be helping the ISO, and what happens instead is that CSRS has to purchase all the power. And the reason is the emergency. It was utter chaos at the time. And so we always thought it was absolutely obvious that CSRS, in its role as the purchaser of last resort, would have the same status and the same refund protection as FERC had already granted as to the ISO and PX, because, in fact, CSRS was the ISO and the PX.
So now the argument has a lot of visceral and other appeal as to why you should be treated the same. From a legal standpoint, the question is why must FERC treat you the same? Not why might it be a good idea, but why did they abuse their discretion in not treating you as if you had stepped in?
Well, Your Honor, FERC now
were the auction market, in effect.
FERC now says on appeal, and says for the first time on appeal, that it didn't have the power to do what we ask. And it says that it didn't have the power to do what we ask because sellers didn't have notice. And because sellers didn't have notice, the filed rate doctrine applies and bars FERC from giving what it would say are retroactive refunds. For all the reasons I've just said, we would say sellers had notice.
Well, it gets back, to my first question, is the breadth of the complaint. And if you read the San Diego complaint as saying we're challenging the market and defining market broadly, then it would necessarily include perhaps some changes in the market that were occasioned. If you read it more narrowly, that just involved the ISO and PX markets, then I think that probably adversely affects your position.
I agree, Your Honor. And we would submit that it's an abuse of discretion to view the situation narrowly under the circumstances and to rebut specifically FERC's claim that it doesn't have the power, because I think that's that is FERC's claim now on appeal.
So if that were the case, in other words, if it were determined, if that's FERC's position that it didn't have the power, but in fact as a legal matter it did have power, then it would be a misapprehension of its authority, and that could be, that's a legal basis for abuse of discretion.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
However, and we'll explore that with FERC, obviously, but go back then to why, in your view, FERC had the authority or the power to include CSRS within this overall refund scheme.
Two reasons, Your Honor. The first reason is Sellers did have notice, and because Sellers had notice, and the only issue there is a legal issue.
It's on the complaint and FERC orders as to whether they had notice or not, right?
That's right, Your Honor. And what I'm saying when I say it's a legal issue is that the issue for filed rate doctrine purposes is, was there adequate notice?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And our response to that is, of course there was adequate notice. How could there not have been adequate notice? The FERC created the problem of the PX going out of business. The sellers created the problem of not selling to the ISO. CSRS had to step in to do what was necessary, and it did. And everybody understood that this was all part of the same central market. CSRS was just a continuation of the ISO and PX. So that's one reason. The second reason is we discovered later that there was all kinds of manipulation going on, as you're well aware. And if there's manipulation going on, as Mr. Berman already said, there doesn't need to be notice because the sellers aren't charging their filed rates. And so that's a wholly separate legal basis for FERC to give refunds here. We don't think it's necessary because we think we fit well within the scope of the proceeding that FERC set here. But if that's not acceptable, if you reject our argument on that point, then FERC had a wholly separate legal basis to give us relief, and that is the fact that there was manipulation. Sellers weren't charging their filed rates. So the very theory that applies to the summer also then would apply to CSRS.
Okay. Your time has expired unless there are further questions from the panel. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Lane? I'm sorry.
San Diego.
Did not want to forget San Diego, particularly in San Diego.
Thank you, Your Honor, sitting back there with the citizens. May it please the Court, my name is Robert O'Neill. I'm going to try to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, and if I succeed, I'll be the first one. On behalf of the City of San Diego and its citizens, I'd like to thank this Court for choosing this venue. San Diego was the first geographic area in California to experience the benefits of the deregulated markets that were being brought. Being here in the Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice seems particularly appropriate because for a long time, these citizens have been looking for some justice for what transpired during the summer of 2002 and thereafter. We have one issue to the Court, and our issue is quite simply that a fundamental element of market-based rate authority is the existence of a functioning competitive market. It doesn't require mens rea to destroy the market. It's an absolute requirement that the market exist. If the market does not exist for any reason, market-based rates cannot withstand the scrutiny dictated by Section 205 of the Federal Power Act. Now, our argument is bounded by two parameters. On the one hand, we do not challenge the basic concept that market-based rates and market-based rate authority are not per se illegal. On the other hand, we certainly accept the recognition by this Court and California XRL Lockyer that the Commission cannot, under the statute, deregulate electric sellers or deregulate electric markets. It's ultra vires and lacks the statutory authority to do so. Now, the principle, when you talk about rates, and I'm going to get to the nuts and bolts decisions here,
And the Lockyer decision, the court concluded by pointing out that the commission couldn't deregulate the markets, but it didn't go into any great detail as to how traditional FERC rate making would have the effect of providing the relief, providing the protection for customers that is being sought in these appellate proceedings. And basically, our position is that the FERC made a fundamental error of law, not discretion, law, when it concluded it lacked the authority to order refunds, because what the commission should have simply acknowledged, that historically it has two types of rates. It has fixed rates, it has formula rates. In a fixed rate, there is a unit charge that is duly filed, subject to notice, it can be protested, the commission can reject it, accept it subject to refund, and once it has been accepted, the filed rate doctrine provides a degree of protection. Formula rate is different. A formula rate is not subject to prior notice. It is not subject to protest. Customers cannot come in before that rate takes effect and say, this is wrong. The safeguard, the statutory safeguard, exists because the FERC can go back. Classic example is the fuel clause. In the fuel clause, the fuel charges pass through automatically. But if the FERC determines that there were imprudent fuel purchases, that if a company was imprudent in operating its generation, it can nevertheless go back and provide refunds. And that is because that is the only way that the commission can maintain the full bond of protection that the Federal Power Act was intended to supply. Now, the commission, this court, this panel.
Could you respond to what I think is one of the arguments that FERC makes, and that is in a formula rate, which you are analogizing, that you have specificity, for example, the one you just gave by way of example, but you don't have that in this kind of hybrid third kind of market structure that we have present here.
Certainly. The first thing, the reason that formula rates have been tolerated, have been allowed, is due to the lack of specificity in charges. It's due to the volatility of fuel clauses. But you have two components in the formula rate. You will have, on the one hand, things such as the specificity of a formula. Take a fuel clause. The fuel clause will say the charges that are booked to account number 456, whatever the appropriate fuel accounts are. What the fuel clause does not articulate, but the commission has nevertheless recognized and the courts have upheld, is just because you book a charge to that account doesn't mean that it becomes a just and reasonable filed rate that is not subject to refund. In imprudently incurred cost, actions regarding the failure to properly manage the plants, these are things that are not articulated in 18 CFR 3514, which are the fuel clause regulations, but it is recognized you cannot have a just and reasonable rate if you allow this to occur.
So let's say you bloat your plant costs unreasonably. You're saying that's equivalent to manipulating some part of the market.
That's correct. Or in the case of what we're saying is manipulation is mens rea. What we're saying is it need not be manipulation, because when the commission granted market-based rate authority, the commission did not say, we hereby permit you to charge without notice of prior filing anything you can get away with unless you have evil intent. What the commission said is the citizens, the customers that we are statutorily prescribed to protect will have that protection because there will be a competitive market. And I'm reminded when I was listening to the questions from the panel and the arguments in the first argument of a case which we did not cite, the Scenic Hudson case, Scenic Hudson v. FERC, with that famous quote about the responsibility of the commission is to not sit by idly calling balls and strikes. Its responsibility to the customers it is supposed to protect is to assure that the rates are just and reasonable. And could the commission have issued market-based rate authority? And remember, it's not the market-based rate, it's the market-based rate authority. And when the commission tried to correct things, it didn't go to individual market-based rate authority, individual tariffs. It went to try to correct the markets. The commission recognized that the markets had failed, and it was the markets that were supposed to provide the protection, the price tempering effect. That's what broke down. And certainly nobody with market-based rate authority could say with a straight face that they had the expectation to be able to extract unjust and unreasonable rates in dysfunctional markets and they could rely upon the filed rate doctrine to allow them to retain those funds. So our point is fundamentally that the FERC, when granting market-based rate authority, implicitly had to give an implicit refund protection, because otherwise it would have been an ultra vires act that would have been prescribed by the statute. And I see I've maintained the same success with my colleagues in reserving absolutely no time.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Now, Mr. Lane.
Thank you. Is there any particular place you'd like me to start?
Well, why don't you start with the 309 argument, and your argument that the California parties cannot seek the remedies of 309 in this proceeding.
Well, I think to get that in proper context, you have to look at temporally how this case came about and how the commission responded to it, because I don't think that the commission necessarily stated that it was not going to exercise 309 powers in certain situations. But recall, when this case first came to the commission, it was with the San Diego complaint, and whether it was filed under Rule 206 or some other rule, or was attempted to be as broad as possible, we have to follow the statutory construction, and that's going to be when a complaint is filed. It's going to be initially under 206. In the situation that occurred at that...
All complaints are under 206?
All complaints are under 206 where there's an existing rate. The only way that you can eliminate an existing rate is under 206. The only way we can eliminate an existing rate is under 206.
Is there anything a complainant can do to raise issues under 309 or some other section, under 205?
Well, the way the – let me just talk about 205 and 206 first, and then we'll come back to 309. 205 is the power of an applicant to come into us and seek a rate increase or particular rate authority. So, for example, when these sellers wanted to have market-based rate authority, they had to come to us under what's called a Section 205 filing and ask for market-based rate authority. At that time, people could come in and protest the filing. The way that we look at market-based rate authority is whether the applicant either does not have market power or market power is adequately mitigated. So if you wanted to protest and say they did have the power, at that time a decision is made either they can have the market-based rate authority or not. And the same thing would occur back in the days when I started and we had cost-based rates. You'd come in with your rate's going to be X, people would come in and fight about whether it should be X or Y. It's the same thing. So you could protest at that time. But once you have the market-based or the cost-based rate, that's when 206 comes in. That's what I meant by having an existing approved rate at the commission. And the only way that you can challenge it at the time under the Act is through a 206. The only way we can change it, and there's certain specific statutory standards that we have to follow. That is, we have to find the existing rate is unjust and unreasonable. Then we have to set what will be the just and reasonable rate to follow. Now, where 309 comes in part, as you heard yesterday, it gives us what the courts have called implementary power. It doesn't give us any substantive power. It just says you can take any and all acts needed to enforce the statute. So we would go back to 206 and 205, and if we see a gap, we would attempt through 309 to fill that gap in a way that was consistent with the underlying purposes of those two sections.
But I take it it's not your position that a party is precluded from seeking a 309 remedy in what you've termed the 206 proceeding. Right.
Absolutely not.
So then the issue here is, why didn't FERC allow these parties to pursue a 309 remedy. And your answer seems to be is that we had our own ideas about 309 and we had a separate proceeding. Isn't that sort of what it comes down to?
No, I don't think so, Judge Thomas. That's why I said go to where we were temporally. At the time when this San Diego complaint was filed, the commission responded by saying, look, we think there are some serious market structure problems. In particular, the one that you see is there's an over-reliance on spot markets, which we, with the day ahead, the hour ahead, the real-time, and the ancillary markets. And so the commission said, as you recall, this is in the Cal-PX case that was heard by this court, look, we see these structural problems. We think those are going to create a conditions where market power may be exercised, and so we're going to try to stop those conditions. And we, without going through them all, we brought in various structural changes. That was our first step. Then we started with the refund proceedings to try to build on what we had done with the structural changes and start to look to the past period and getting money back to customers. Then, I'm really telescoping this, but yes. Then we got some more information pretty much about the manipulation that was occurring in the market, and that's when we started a whole different series of proceedings attempting to go through those particular problems. So the way I would look at it is the commission saw a particular set of problems initially. It reacted to those. Then it tried to expand that a little bit. Then a whole new set of problems came in or a whole new set of allegations came in and responded to that. So I don't think we were attempting to limit, certainly being at the commission at the time, I know there were a lot of people within the commission attempting creatively to come up with all different kinds of solutions. So I don't think we were saying, well, oh, no, we're going to back away from 309. What we were saying
is... what you said was that we're not going to allow these parties to pursue a 309 remedy in this case. We're going to pursue it in a way we choose, right?
Exactly.
And what... You know, it's basic, it seems to me, black-letter administrative law to say... When a party takes an issue to you to adjudicate, you have to adjudicate it. You can't just say, well, we have an investigatory proceeding, and therefore we're going to ignore your complaint in this case. And what principle gives you the right, if properly presented, and that's, I know that's an issue, to say we're not going to deal with that issue in this case, we're going to instead use an entirely different procedure to pursue the remedy?
Well, first of all, I would say that we didn't say we were just going to... Again, I would come back to the point that this occurred over time, and what we set... What's happened here is... that people are trying to compress everything, that we knew everything. If we knew everything that we knew now on the day the San Diego complaint came in, we would have reacted differently. But we didn't know everything.
I take your point, and I understand that FERC is trying to respond in a way it thinks is the most appropriate way of pursuing a 309 remedy, but that doesn't answer the California party's complaint that they would like to pursue a 309 remedy. They don't think the way that you're pursuing it may be in accord with the remedies they seek. Why? What's wrong with having a dual track of a 309 remedy?
Well, I think that's precise. I'm not sure what you mean by the 309
well, for example,
remedy.
Let's say, you know, in the criminal analogy we've talked about, the result of a criminal charge may be an order of restitution, but that certainly doesn't preclude anyone from bringing a civil complaint seeking damages from the wrongdoer, the criminal. I know that analogy is imperfect, but isn't that somewhat like the situation we're faced with here? You may end up with a judgment in each case that an order in each case that may be similar, but why? What precludes What precludes these parties from seeking this relief and this, assuming it's properly presented and raised in this forum?
I think the way the commission looked at it was that we are attempting to give them the relief that they requested.
But isn't that sort of a father knows best argument?
Well, we're, with all due respect, we are the expert agency, and we do have a statutory mandate, and we do have statutory controls. And one of the just to be quite blunt about it, under the APA, we have an absolute discretion to choose what cases to prosecute, to decide not to take action if we choose on past conduct. We have an absolute discretion to decide to settle cases. So we have a wide range, but in this case, the commission, when the 100-day evidence came up and the commission staff report was finished, the commission was sort of at the point where I think you are, Judge Thomas, in saying, look, we have this refund case that's been going on for a while. We suddenly have a whole bunch of new evidence related to manipulation. What are we going to do? The commission gave very sound reasons, and we quote them in our brief, basically saying, look, this case is pretty far along. We're getting some refunds back. We have a whole bunch of new issues. A lot of this evidence is new. We're just starting to investigate it. We're going to decide to treat those in two separate sets of proceedings, as it were. And we think this is helpful not only to us in the administration of our act, but it's also helpful to the parties because some parties, I think we note the small parties would be in a mega proceeding, as we called it, where the whole bunch of issues where we don't think that's economically viable for them to be when they may only have a small issue. So I think what the commission did in response to the situation you are saying is that we looked at the whole circumstances within our discretion. We decided how to order our dockets, and we ordered them in a way that dealt with the refund proceeding, continued it on, and with the manipulation in different proceedings where we thought it was going to be better addressed in terms of procedures, economics, efficiency.
But what was their concern?
Go ahead. No. The puzzling thing to me, though, is that in that case is before a different panel, and FERC takes the position that, no, we're not going to let the California parties intervene in the larger case, and therefore they're precluded, in your view, from any relief at all or from being heard before FERC on this issue, right?
That's correct. That is a position that we have that this is not an issue that is only in this case. That is a position that, as you know from the briefs, Baltimore Gas and Electric involving the Natural Gas Act, there are other cases. In investigations, again, we have absolute discretion. The panel that was hearing the prior case, recall, limited the issue to whether the party should be allowed to intervene or not. That is what the issue is in those cases.
Sure.
We have the right to decide whether they should be intervening because we are the people who are investigating and the settlement is made through us. So, yes, but that's what the law is.
So just to kind of boil it down, it doesn't really matter then what the scope of the complaint is. Because in the end, once you start the investigation, it's wholly within FERC's discretion to figure out how to both structure the investigation and potential remedies?
I don't think that's correct.
Okay.
I think that the investigations, recall, related to the manipulation. So they were separate and apart from the San Diego complaint. And so the San Diego complaint, we did try to make that as broad as possible within what we term to be our statutory limits. But the cases of manipulation, when you get down to it, we have to look at individual companies to determine whether they manipulated the market, whether they individually abused their market power. So to prove that kind of conduct, it has to be on an individual-by-individual investigation. So there were two separate proceedings.
Right, but let's go back to, let's take the timing issue. The period preceding the effective date. The California parties basically say we need a market-wide relief for that period and not this individual, what they call the splinter proceedings. You're saying, no, we are going to look at them company by company and see whether there was market manipulation. So it seems like, I mean, in a way, the issues aren't even joined, is kind of what I'm saying, and I'm having trouble getting my hands around why the Commission's position for not including a market-wide remedy for this pre-October period.
Well, the Commission didn't limit its remedies. Remember, it listed several remedies, one of which was to make the market whole. So it didn't limit the remedies. It just said we're not going to deal with it in this proceeding. If the findings were made that there was enough evidence to show that there should be a market, an individual company were required to make the market whole, the Commission would settle on that basis. I don't think the Commission's investigations are somehow limited to what ultimate relief should be granted. It may be stated in different terms, but the Commission tried to be as broad as possible in allowing different types of relief for these individual market investigations.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by make the market whole. And in particular, we've had the allegation or the argument that it shouldn't be necessary to prove manipulation on the part of all of the sellers to retrieve the overcharge if an overcharge is deemed to be unjust or unreasonable. Suppose you find a market which is, in this case, was broken through the manipulation of a few individuals, not all sellers, but a few, but they, by their manipulation, they have the effect of raising the price for everybody.
Right.
Now, in these individual proceedings, the investigative proceedings that are still going on, are you saying that, that making the market whole means recovering in some fashion for the buyers everything that was overcharged, or only the overcharges that wound up in the pockets of the ones who were actually manipulating?
The former. Judge Clifton, in the Reliance settlement that's in our brief that dealt with those 2 days in June, that settlement was based on making the market whole. The settlement was not limited to the sales that Reliant was involved in, but was and covered all the sales that were made on those two particular days. So, yes, when we say make the market whole, what we mean is that in certain situations we will attempt a settlement or we'll – let me put it this way. We are looking for relief that is as broad as possible, and in certain circumstances we will give it for the entire market, even though only one seller – is being investigated.
But it boils down to trust us, I guess, because are you suggesting that really from a legal standpoint there's nothing this court or the parties can do to influence or structure FERC's idea of how to go about this?
We always read your opinions very carefully. We always follow whatever it is you tell us, but ultimately, ultimately, under the APA and these and investigations and prosecutorial decisions, we have absolute discretion, and that was given to us by Congress, or more important, it was taken away from you by Congress. And yes, ultimately, Congress trust the agencies, yes, you'll have to do that.
When you say absolute, what's contained in absolute? You know, on what level is there review by us on this petition for review? What standard are we supposed to apply? Is it truly absolute?
In a case, if you read the if you read Baltimore Gas and Electric, yes, it's absolute. You do not have authority under the APA to review whatever decision it is that we come up with on how best to settle a case or whether or not we should have prosecuted past conduct.
Well, that can't be. You can't really mean that in an absolute sense. If, for example, if the commission said, we're only going to prosecute people whose company names begin with S, and the rest of you have a nice day, is it your position that this court or any court would have no oversight authority under abuse of discretion to take a look at that?
Recall, I said only about past conduct. In other words, only about an adjudicatory matter that has a defined, discrete set of facts. Now, if we did the situation that you're saying, we would be saying in the future we're never going to prosecute A through Z except for the S people.
No. I mean, if you said right now, I've gone through all of these, and the only 309 claims I'm going to bring are the S people. And the others I'm just not going to bring. And I'm going to bring them because we like the sound of S at the commission. Would this court have no authority, or no court would have any authority to say, well, that's an interesting theory, but that you have stepped over the line, or is it your position that you still have absolute discretion no matter what in what to proceed?
We read the law. The law is that would not be reviewable, but of course.
Then we might as well just pack up our notebooks and go home, I guess, because.
Well,
I mean, in your view, I guess that's what you'd like us
right,
to do.
Right. In our view, that's exactly right. In what we have done. We were the ones who, in the other case, said you can only raise a question of whether you should be allowed to intervene in that case.
Right, but aren't
you? Yes, we're going to file motions. Yes, just to be clear, FERC will file a motion saying we have absolute discretion and this should be limited to whether you should intervene or not.
But I understand your point on the prosecutorial discretion, but aren't you blurring the lines between your adjudicatory function and your role as a regulator in the prosecutorial role, because what you're doing, it seems to me in this case, is hijacking an adjudicated case or a case subject to adjudication and saying, oh, no, we can't adjudicate the case brought because we are also going to prosecute it independently. And I think that's the problem here.
Go ahead. Again, that theory is tied to the fact that all these cases should have been brought in what's called the refund proceeding. And the commission looked at that question, gave very, in my opinion, very sound reasons for not putting this all in a mega proceeding, but if you want to call it splintering it into different proceedings, and what happened is it is settling those proceedings. And that's the part where we have absolute discretion. So the refund proceeding has not gone away. The scope is not as broad as petitioners would like, but it hasn't gone away.
But within that proceeding, the parties have a statutory right to initiate the proceeding. And I take it your position is once they do that, however, they don't actually have the right to determine the size of the box of that proceeding. That really lies within the commission's discretion.
They didn't institute. No one brought the 206 that started the investigations. The commission started those investigations on its own motion after looking at the staff report and the 100-day evidence. So
what's the effect of the San Diego Gas and Electric's you know, kickoff proceeding, if you will. Does that just kind of float out of existence, or?
No, we've been adjudicating that for I don't know how many years now.
Well, right, but I mean,
and
the
it's still
question
being adjudicated.
What are we adjudicating? Is your adjudication too narrow, as some people think, or is it too broad?
I think it's just right.
I know you. Thank you, Goldilocks.
You're over your time, but do you want to briefly address the CSRS argument, or do you want to rest on your briefs on that?
If you have some questions, I'll be happy to answer them. I don't want to take time away from my other parties, but I'll leave that up to you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Nice to see you again, Mr. Penning.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mark Penning, of the U.S. Department of Justice. I appear before you today in support of FERC because on the issues that we are interveners, and I appear on not only behalf of Bonneville Power Administration, but also on behalf of the other municipalities who have intervened in support of FERC, and on behalf of a private utility, a public utility, excuse me, a Pacific Corp. We all have issues in common here that FERC, on these issues, was right.
Yesterday, they're dead wrong.
Yesterday, on the jurisdictional, they were dead wrong. But it's not unusual for agencies to be right on some things and not on others. But on these issues, I want to address briefly the CSRS sales as from a governmental entity's perspective, because that's what we are here. The FERC is absolutely right as to these entities, especially, that these sales are not covered. Because on this, to these sales between, say, BPA and CSRS, they're both governmental entities. There is no tariff. There is no file rate. It's a bilateral sale. FERC doesn't have any power to address it, period.
Well, what the California parties respond to that, it seems to me, and I paraphrase an argument probably inartfully, is that the San Diego complaint was broad enough to allege an entire market, and it wasn't restricted to 206 or 205. It was enough to put sellers on notice, and that the subsequent FERC orders were sufficient to put everyone on notice that the entire market was going to be examined, and not just the ISO PX markets.
Actually,
how do you respond to that?
To take issue with that briefly, and these are the points made by Mr. Shapiro yesterday, the San Diego complaint was addressed to those who had market authority conferred by FERC, public entities, the public utilities, the governmental utilities are not selling pursuant to any market-based authority. FERC's authority here is to seek refunds or even to enforce Section 205 is based solely on Section as to public utilities. None of the governmental entities are public utilities. There is no notice for the governmental entities as to FERC's jurisdiction here. In fact, we didn't even participate until the FERC made it clear that they're going to reach out and grab the governmental entities on a very broad order that came out in July. There was no notice as to the governmental entities, and there couldn't be because there's no tariff. There's no filed rate. Remember, we're dealing with the statute here. And the statute requires for FERC to have a change under Section 206. It's a change of the tariff, of the filed rate. When BPA sells the service, it's not doing so under a filed rate. It's doing so pursuant to its authority conferred by the Northwest Power Act. The municipalities are selling pursuant to the authority that they have under their statutes that create them. There's no filed rate for FERC to administer there. It's something that jurisdictionally FERC doesn't have any power over. It's not just because of Section 201. It's just because there's no tariff, period. Let's talk about tariff in the context of...
Let me just step back. If you were correct yesterday, just hypothetically...
I like the hypothetically.
Just hypothetically. Would that moot out your even making this argument today?
If we're correct yesterday that FERC has no jurisdiction over the governmental entities, then yes, it would.
Okay. So now let's say that you were incorrect yesterday and your colleague, Mr. Lane, was correct, and there is jurisdiction. Then How does your argument proceed?
Well, our argument here is in support of FERC as to the things that FERC held that it did not have jurisdiction or did not address, and we're suggesting that FERC is correct in those holdings. So from the perspective of the bilateral sales, we think FERC was correct. And Mr. Frederick's going to address it from a perspective of the private utilities.
Right. But I gather your notice argument is confined to the governmental entities. You'd say, in any event, even if you have jurisdiction, the San Diego complaint wasn't sufficient to put governmental utilities on it.
I'm stressing this because I don't want the court to lose sight of the fact that we do have a notice provision. It's embodied in Section 206, and this complaint couldn't possibly put governmental entities on notice. And we can't lose sight of the side of the legislative scheme that we're dealing with here. Now, this has great emphasis.
Why wouldn't it put them on notice if the challenge in the complaint is basically that the whole market has fallen apart and is bollocked up, and the entities you represent are a major player in that market? Why isn't that enough notice?
Well, because the complaint didn't say that. The complaint said that sought only relief against the sellers that had market-based authority from FERC. The complaint is explicit on that. The orders of the commission.
Public utilities.
The public utilities. That's correct. And FERC's orders are explicit on that over and over again. And it was not until July of 2001 that FERC changed its mind on that.
Is that realistic?
I mean, yes.
The San Diego complaint said the market's broken, cap the rates. And if the rates had been capped, they wouldn't have been paying the governmental entities a whole lot more because they wouldn't have been subject to that order. Everybody's rates are going to go up and down at the same time.
Well, to the extent that FERC caps the market, then certainly everybody who sells into that market is going to be affected by
that. And that wouldn't have come as a huge shock to the governmental entities.
No, of course not. But the refund,
you say they didn't
the refund
notice?
Question is a huge shock to the governmental entities because in the history of the Federal Power Act, no governmental entity has ever been subjected to a refund requirement. That's a shock. Indeed, the dissent calls it a shock.
Okay, now, what does that have to do with today's argument?
Well, today's argument on the idea of bilateral sales is that the sales between, say, BPA and SERS are precisely the sales not covered by the Federal Power Act because there is no tariff, there is no filed rate. And those are the things that the statute limits FERC's authority to change under Section 206 and to remedy under Section 205. But it also has an impact on the formula rate argument that the California parties are pushing here. And this is important because the formula is precisely that, a formula. You have data, the inputs, the outcomes, the result. But the result here that the California parties is skipping the data input, the result is the competitive market. There's no formula. This is the result. That violates the filed rate doctrine. In the Lockyer decision, this Court sustained filed rates because the filed rates the actual charges were, in fact, filed with FERC. In the formula case, the filed rate is not the actual charges. It's the formula. In Lockyer decision, the court held that FERC has the power to remedy that under Section 205 as a violation of a filed tariff because it didn't make the required filings that would enable FERC to enforce. Under 206, and under 205, but particularly under 206, is its ability to determine whether or not the rates were reasonable. That, if you accept the formula rate argument offered by the California party, that reads out 206 entirely out of the statutory scheme because every rate, every sale that is determined years later not to have been on a competitive market basis becomes a violation of the tariff. And that's absurd. On the basis of this statutory scheme, it's absurd on the premises that this court operated on in ruling in Lockyer. The whole idea there is to have the rate itself, the sale, as the filed rate. It's a violation of the filed rate doctrine. It also affords the sellers no notice. Remember, everybody's selling into this market, and nobody knows for sure exactly where this new competitive rate will be. But in the meantime, they have to make the sales. The whole idea of Section 206 is to allow the commission to say, okay, we're going to have a date for a refund here so that everybody has notice. Now, the whole premise of your decision in Lockyer was that the commission has that authority to remedy the date the rates that are actually filed. Now, if, in fact, there's manipulation, that's a Section 205 violation. That's a violation of the tariff. And the commission has the authority to do that. Just as you held in Lockyer that a failure to file the actual sale is a violation of the tariff. So they have Section 205 authority over that. But does it mean that every rate that was filed properly becomes a Section 205 violation? Those are the types of sales that Section 206 was intended to remedy, because the whole idea of there is to say the rate that was filed has become unreasonable. And then we're going to remedy that prospectively under Section 206. The formula rate doctrine abolishes that. It
Thank
doesn't
you.
Work.
Thank you, counsel. Time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm David Frederick on behalf of the Competitive Supplier Group. I'd like to start with your question, Judge Thomas, about the difference between 206 and 309, because there is law on this subject, and I want to direct the Court to several cases that have been decided by the Supreme Court. The first, which we highlight in our brief on page 25, is the Mobile Oil case, in which the Court said, quote, an agency enjoys broad discretion in determining how best to handle related yet discrete issues in terms of procedures and priorities. In four reply briefs, tens of thousands of words, there is not a single mention of the Mobile Oil case, which is at 498 U.S., and I quoted from pages 230 to 231. Now, in evaluating the standards of whether or not an agency has or can bring or should have brought a complaint, the Supreme Court addressed that in Heckler versus Cheney. And in that case, the Court said that an agency has very broad discretion in deciding whether or not to bring an action. So if you couple Heckler with Mobil Oil, it's clear that FERC here had broad discretion in deciding whether to bring it and in how to address it once allegations had been brought. It's perfectly logical to think of the way FERC handled this, because 206 is forward-looking in terms of whether or not rates going into the future are going to be addressed as just and reasonable, whereas the tariff violations that the Cal parties have asserted, and I would add parenthetically, have been looked at very comprehensively and for the most part rejected as a matter of fact by the Commission staff and the Commission. But those are backward-looking. They're more prosecutorial in function rather than regulating in terms of what should be ongoing. And I would like to address the Court also to Rule 206 of the Commission's rules, which specify what a complaint has to contain. B1 of those rules says the complainant has to identify the specific statutory violation that is alleged to have occurred. The San Diego complaint didn't do that. B7 of those rules says the complaint has to identify the specific relief requested. The only relief requested in the San Diego Gas and Electric complaint was price caps. It didn't identify refunds. It didn't identify tariff violations. All of those kinds of things arose later on. So in terms of putting parties on notice about what the Commission was investigating and what it would be holding people accountable for, the SDG&E complaint was quite limited, and the Commission, when it formalized its investigation through the issuance of its order on August 23rd, set forth the standards by which it was going to decide how to proceed with these investigations. Now, I'd like briefly to address the canard, and it is an utter and complete canard on the part of the California parties that no one is looking at these tariff violations, which they have asserted occurred every day during this period. That is false. The Commission has looked at these allegations. The Cal parties have submitted reams of information making largely false charges against many of the sellers for having committed tariff violations, and those are in the process of being evaluated by the Commission. And the staff report, which is a 400-page staff report going allegation by allegation through many of these, have found not only
the 309 proceedings?
That's correct. That's correct. These are some 70 proceedings against individual sellers. Now, the logic is a matter of prosecutorial discretion. The Cal parties would like to have everybody involved. But if you're a small party and you have limited resources for monitoring this investigation, it's far more logical to think that if you have purchased power from a particular seller, that it is a more discreet way to handle the investigation if it is done on a seller-by-seller basis. And the Commission under Heckler and Mobil Oil certainly has the discretion to perform its investigation in that manner. Now, I would further point out that the Cal parties have intervened in the gaming and show cause orders, which we appended to our brief. And in those investigations, the Commission addressed specific allegations of specific alleged market manipulations. In some cases, the Commission said, we have enough information to show cause to particular sellers to answer for those, and that triggered additional proceedings. But the Cal parties are part of that. That is the case that was before the D.C. Circuit and has recently been transferred to this court. So it is simply false for them to say that they are not parties to those proceedings and that this court doesn't have review, because it does, and it will. And those cases will be set for briefing and argument. The Cal parties will have their full and fair opportunity to argue about market manipulation. It's just not this case. Now, with respect,
you differ from Mr. Lane's position that there's no role for this court in reviewing that type of proceeding.
We do largely, Judge McKeown, because we read the D.C. Circuit precedents slightly differently. We agree that the cases say that the agency has broad discretion, but there are cases in which settlements have been challenged and have gone up on judicial review in the D.C. Circuit and have been sent back down because the agency didn't give the Commission, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, didn't give an adequate enough response. That's the Lackleed case, which isn't cited by the briefs, but is at 997 F. 2nd, 936.
Well, to the extent that the review exists, you'd have to agree that it's much more deferential when an appellate court is reviewing a settlement or a prosecutorial decision than it would be, for example, a petition for review from the result of an adjudication.
Well, I think the question is what statutory standard mm-hmm. applies, and what you are addressing in the context of a 206 proceeding is a completely different set of issues than you would be looking at in terms of tariff violations and whether the agency had established the requisite proof for a tariff violation or to extract a settlement from an offending party, and how that would be. But that's no different, Your Honor, than what you face here, because you would be forced, if the Cal parties are correct, to go back, force the Commission to go back, open up a proceeding that is going to become even more unwieldy than it already is, and then you're going to be forced to go party by party by party in judicial review to determine on the basis of standards that are going to be different, whether it's a 206 or a 309 issue, as to whether or not there is some problem that needs to be remedied. And I think, to be perfectly candid, I think the Commission handled this in about as efficient a way in balancing the respective interests of sellers and consumers. Because the Federal Power Act is not just about consumer protection. It's also about providing certainty and notice to sellers so that consumers do have utilities that will provide electric power, so that there is not retroactive rate making and an opportunity for courts to go back and say, we're going to recreate history, we're going to reset the rates, and we're going to force the disgorgement of billions of dollars so that investors are not going to have reasonable expectations about how they spend their money in the generation of power. And the Commission handled that in a perfectly appropriate way with respect to these issues. Now, I would like to briefly address.
We accept the premise of the California parties that the whole market was out of whack, so that some of these investor-owned utilities are even if not involved in any manipulation, but they're receiving the benefits of manipulation by others. At a minimum, you've got a windfall there. And it can be fairly can it be said that the utilities have an inherent right to retain the windfall against challenge because of the need to keep investors confident that you got to keep the electricity flowing?
Judge Clifton, Congress addressed that when it said in the Federal Power Act that retrospective REACH funds were not going to be permitted, even for unjust and unreasonable rates. And the Supreme Court has addressed that 50 years ago in saying that even when rates are found to be ex post facto unjust and unreasonable, refunds are not permitted. And the reason is to create certainty for investors. Now, prospectively, when Congress changed 206 in 1988, it changed the refund effective date period, and it provided more in the way of balance for the consumers. But until that time, under the prior law, there would still be no refund effective date because that would only trigger on a final order of the commission. So for throughout the entire pendency of an investigation, there would be no refunds that would be permitted, even though there was a charge of unjust and unreasonable rates. But that's a balance Congress struck.
It's one thing to talk about certainty to the investor at a time when the rates filed were numbers. You know that's the rate. You know when you sell it's going to be that amount. I think it's something else again. We're talking about market-based rates. The investor doesn't know the rate's going to be 12. It's going to be whatever the market drives at that time.
And many of these sellers, Judge Clifton, were also buying on the market at high prices so that those same uncertainties were being created by marketers who were spying and selling power, and they were attempting to figure out, when I've got to provide power for my consumers, how much am I going to have to pay in order to get that on the market? At a time when California political officials were entreating the sellers to provide electricity in this market, notwithstanding the financial difficulties that were ensuing. The Commission had a difficult set of issues here to deal with, but with respect to these, the Commission did not abuse its discretion. Now, briefly, if I could address the CSRS issue from the seller's perspective, these are bilateral transactions that were never considered part of the 206 proceeding. Bilaterals involve fixed terms for fixed amounts of money, and it is fundamentally different from the single clearing market price that was set by the ISO. And when the Commission repeatedly said, we're focusing on the ISO's single market clearing price formula as the basis of the problem, everyone in the market understood that to mean that when you have a fixed price bilateral contract, that is not part of this and it is not subject to refunds. Importantly, the Commission basically invited the California parties to file a complaint if they thought the CSRS transactions were unjust and unreasonable. That's at excerpts of record, page 182. It's footnote 59 of the July 25th order. There has never been any, by any of the Cal parties or anyone, a 309 complaint. There has never been a CSRS complaint. And that is, as you put it earlier in questions to my colleagues on the other side, Judge Thomas, a tactical choice that they chose to make. It just doesn't happen to conform with the applicable and governing law. Unless the Court has any further questions.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you. I wish we could allow time for rebuttal, but I think we're running a little late, and we appreciate the excellent arguments you've all made. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes, after which we'll take time for us. We'll hear the stage tour.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Lawrence Acker, appearing on behalf of the Competitive Supplier Group. In this stage of the argument, the Competitive Supplier Group will present argument on the deficiencies of the Commission's order, particularly under Section 206 of the Federal Power Act. The portion that I've been asked to discuss deals with the out-of-market transactions in particular. While the facts of the California market during this period of turmoil are complicated indeed, the duties imposed on the Commission by Section 206A of the Federal Power Act are not that complicated. Section 206A requires the Commission, and please excuse me for just reading a little bit of text to you, says that any complaint or motion of the Commission to initiate a proceeding under this section shall state the change or changes to be made in the rate, charge, classification, rule, regulation, practice, or contract then in force and the reasons for any proposed change or changes therein. In short, Congress struck a balance and said that when it amended Section 206 to provide refund authority, something that prior to 1988 was absent from Section 206, was that you must provide a respondent with clear, specific notice of what the changes you seek to implement. In large part, this was to enable respondents to evaluate the nature of the claims that were presented to them and determine whether their conduct should change. In this instance, that would have enabled people who were engaging in out-of-market transactions to make a determination whether to exit this market because the risks were too profound. We submit that if the notice provided by the FERC wasn't clear and specific, then it fails the test of Section 206. And there's abundant evidence in this case that that's exactly what happened. When we examine the August 23rd order of the Commission and its discussion of out-of-market transactions, at each instance, it's talking about changes in connection with out-of-market transactions to the way the market functions. It comes under the heading of market reforms rather than seller conduct. In the ordering paragraph in the August 23rd order, what the Commission set for hearing was the justness and reasonableness of sales into the ISO and PX markets, not out of those markets. In its notice of August 3rd in the Federal Register, what the Commission provided notice to the parties about the San Diego complaint was about bid prices. That's simply another way of saying the transactions that are being conducted in the market rather than out of market. There are no bid prices for out of market transactions. One of the commissioners, who was a concurring commissioner in the Commission's November 1st order, at Joint Excerpts of Record, page 50, characterized what the Commission had said about refunds in the following way. Today's order employs mushy and confusing language on the subject of refunds, indecipherable to all but the most devoted of FERC insiders. Yesterday, when the Commission defended its orders against the challenge of the governmental utilities, counsel for the Commission explained to this Court that what the Commission was dealing with was the clearing price single price auction. That was the focus of the Commission's orders. It's very clear that what was happening, and I think you heard discussion of it earlier this morning, was the Commission was learning more and getting more familiar with the subject matter and expanding the scope of its activities so that by July 25th, it now said out-of-market transactions are going to be subject to refund. It said that for the first time with any clarity on July 25th. It said that in response it claimed to various requests of the adversary parties to clarify the order. Well, two things are abundantly clear. If the Commission had satisfied the test of Section 206 to provide sellers with the clear notice that was required, it wouldn't have had to clarify its order, and the adversary parties wouldn't have had to ask it to clarify its order. It wasn't until July 25th of 2001, a month after the termination of the refund period, that sellers were first put on notice that these out-of-market transactions would be subject to refund. There was no way that they could conform their conduct to anybody if they had evaluated it as wanting. They certainly couldn't exit the market. They certainly couldn't change anything. It was a month too late. That certainly can't satisfy the requirements of Section 206. Moreover, when the Commission said that out-of-market transactions are the functional equivalent of in-market transactions, that couldn't possibly have been right. The Commission, in its brief, says the Commission relied on substantial evidence, and yet every record site that's contained in the Commission's brief to you is a cite to other Commission orders. There isn't a cite to any evidence. Had they cited to the August 23rd order what they would have cited to the correct portion of the August 23rd order, they would have cited to the portion of that order in which the Commission directed the ISO to immediately cease using out-of-market transactions to satisfy that last-minute need. Moreover, and to engage in more forward transactions, that is, to use out-of-market transactions for something other than the last minute. And this makes sense given the structure of the market. The way the bid stack worked, the in-market transactions, is that the ISO arrayed the different bids in ascending price order, and as it satisfied demand in the market, it would start with the least expensive and move up to the most expensive. In times of extreme need, those most expensive units, called peakers, but also called junkers because they burn so inefficiently that they are extremely expensive. The prices of those junk units would have been applied in a clearing price auction to every bid in the market. Out-of-market transactions had a different function. Every out-of-transaction that the ISO negotiated bilaterally with a seller would take one of those very high-priced units right out of the stack so that all of the other sellers wouldn't get that very high-priced unit. And that's what the Commission insisted that the ISO do with out-of-market transactions, and there's no reason to believe that that's not what happened. So, Your Honors, the notice that was provided to the sellers by the FERC was inadequate. It was too late. It wasn't clear. And as a consequence, we couldn't have been exposed to refund obligation except after July 25th, as I say, after the end of the refund period. And moreover, the Commission couldn't have had and didn't have any substantial evidence to rely on in concluding that in-market transactions and out-of-market transactions were the same thing.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. From the very beginning of this case, FERC stated only that the dysfunctional market design in the state of California had the potential to cause prices to become unjust and unreasonable under certain conditions. FERC later defined what those conditions were as periods of tight supply, which it found to be periods when the ISO declared system emergencies. FERC never stated that those periods, those conditions related to non-emergency hours, which are those hours when supply and demand are in balance, and which FERC held in its April 26, 2001 order at Joint Excerpts of Record 072, the market was functioning as a competitive market would be expected to function. But notwithstanding these findings, FERC ordered refunds for sales that occurred both during emergency and non-emergency hours, and in so doing, FERC violated Section 206 of the Federal Power Act, which imposes a conditioned precedent, in the words of the Supreme Court in the Sierra Pacific case, to make a finding that prices are unjust and unreasonable before it can even begin to move to the remedy stage to determine what the refunds would be. If you don't make the antecedent finding, you don't even get to the refund stage.
Would you just clarify for me, were all of the non-emergency hours part of the central auction proceedings?
The issue that I'm raising, yes, Your Honor. I'm only dealing with the central auction markets for the ISO and the CalPX. I'm not talking expressly to the out-of-market sales, although, as Mr. Ackert said there, the Commission did not make adequate findings for those sales as well. On its brief, the Commission points to two passages in its December 19, 2001 order, in which it claims it made the required statutory findings. In the first passage, however, FERC merely stated that the systemic dysfunctions in the market had the potential to cause prices not to be economic. FERC doesn't mention MMCP in this sentence and doesn't say that prices above the MMCP were unjust and unreasonable, yet this is the interpretation of this passage that its attorney provides to the Court in its brief. And, in fact, in the April 26th order, and again, I'm referring back to Joint Excerpts of Record, page 72, FERC made the opposite finding when it found that during non-emergency hours, the markets were operating as a competitive market would be expected to operate, and that was because supply and demand were in balance during those hours. So FERC's statement in this passage on which it principally relies upon in its brief does not provide the kind of explicit finding, as the D.C. Circuit held in the Public Service Commission of New York case, that the Commission is required to make in order to invoke its powers under Section 206. We have to remember that Section 206 imposes an explicit burden of proof on the Commission, and so the obligation that the Commission has to carry out Congress's burden is of even greater than the Commission could be held to in a routine, arbitrary, and capricious review. But even if the Commission's statement could be interpreted to mean what its attorney thinks it means, that statement would be wrong. In order to state that the MMCP established the line of division between reasonable and unreasonable prices such that a price $1 above the MMCP during non-emergency hours was unjust and unreasonable, that would have to mean that the MMCP was established at the very top end of the zone of reasonableness, as the Commission has acknowledged in its orders and the December 15th order and many other orders. There is no single precise bright line as to what's a just and reasonable rate. There could be any number of just and reasonable rates. But the Commission never states that the MMCP was at the very top of the zone of reasonableness. The Commission, in fact, never even establishes a zone of reasonableness in this case. But what the Commission did do in later orders is that it allowed the generators to come in and recover emissions costs and fuel costs as add-ons to the MMCP, has stated that it will provide the opportunity for marketers to come in and recover certain of their costs that are not included in the MMCP, all of which will serve to raise the allowable prices that they will have to be at some level above the MMCP. And since the Commission can only authorize a price that is just and reasonable, this necessarily means that the MMCP is not at the top end of the zone of reasonableness, and its statement in its brief that it does set that line such that a price $1 above that line is unjust and unreasonable is simply contrary to the record. The Commission realizes...
Is the determination on the MMCP one of fact, or is it a question of law in your view?
Well, as you will find out in phase two, it is one of fact. There are many, many issues, factual issues, that go into the makeup of the MMCP.
So if that is the case and the determination of it is whatever, you know, FERC says it is, and there's room for argument, as you've just made, but doesn't that mean we ought to defer to FERC on that point?
Your Honor, FERC has an obligation before – that would be saying that we can determine what the refund should be, we can determine what the remedy should be, and then after we make that determination, we can then go back and revisit whether we should have made the finding in the first place. The statute imposes, as I said, a conditioned precedent – this is the Supreme Court's words – to make the finding of a violation first, and unless and until you make that finding, you do not get into the remedy stage. You do not fix a rate that is just and reasonable. And the other thing that needs to bear in mind is that the MMCP establishes a clearing price mechanism so that of which all sellers will receive that price. So the fact that certain sellers may receive add-ons to their MMCPs but not other sellers means that if you rely upon that, some sellers might receive a just and reasonable price, but other sellers who don't receive those add-ons will not. I see my time has expired.
Yeah, thank you, Counsel. Okay.
Thank you. I'll address the refund effective date of October 2nd, in which the Commission erred by violating statute Section 206A and B, by setting the refund effective date of October 2nd. The statute sets out very clearly the paradigm. There either has to be a complaint or there has to be formal notice of an investigation by the Commission. The complaint requirement of 206B is not satisfied here because under Rule 206 of the Commission's rules, the San Diego complaint did not ask for the specific relief of refunds. Sellers into the market, therefore, were not put on notice by the San Diego complaint that they would be subject to refunds. That did not occur until the August 23rd order of the commission in which the commission said it was invoking its power under Section 206B to formally commence an investigation and by issuing formal notice in the Federal Register. That formal notice did not become effective until August 29th. Under the statute, 60 days following is October 29th, and that is what the effective refund effective date has to be under the statute. The Commission has no answer to this, save that 13 months later, it treated this all as sort of one consolidated investigation. But that doesn't answer the requirement of the statute, in which the statute says if it is a complaint, there has to be a specific ground stated in the complaint for what change is required. That's Section 206A. So if you read 206B, 206A, and Rule 206, the San Diego complaint did not put the parties on notice of what the refund effective date would be as of the filing of the San Diego complaint. That did not occur until several weeks later when the commission launched its formal investigation. Now, I would like to address a jurisdictional point that was raised by the Cal parties in a late filing 28J letter in which they challenged the jurisdiction of this court to address this question. This morning we have filed a response to that, but I would like to presage our answer, which is number one, there is no requirement that a party petition for rehearing from the first instance in which the commission issues an order. There is a case on point which we cited in our letter called Kansas Cities versus FERC in which the D.C. Circuit held that a party does not have to challenge it immediately. We did petition for rehearing from the first order in which we were a party. We were not a party at the time of the November 1 order. We became a party by intervening in May 2001, and the commission granted intervener status in June of 2001. So we weren't a party, did not file a petition for rehearing from the November 1 order, but the July 25th order, which incorporated the November 1 refund effective date, was what we petitioned for rehearing from under well-established precedent in the letter that we filed with the court, and we have asked Mr. Benson to circulate it to Chambers as a courtesy. Jurisdiction is clearly vested in this court to resolve this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court, my name is Harvey Ryder. I'm appearing on behalf of governmental entities who have challenged the Commission's decision to impose a refund obligation with respect to four different types of transactions made by governmental entities, OOM, or out-of-market transactions, as the Commission has described them, something else the Commission has called sleeve transactions, multi-day sales, and last, sales made under the emergency powers of the Secretary of Energy under Section 202C, of the Federal Power Act. Let me take the first three that I've named, because all of these transactions are transactions that were bilateral in nature and that were negotiated individually by the parties. That's significant for a reason counsel for FERC stated at yesterday's oral argument, and that really has to do with the fact that the Commission has for 70 years, until this case, never imposed a refund obligation on governmental entities. What counsel for FERC said yesterday was that this was a case where its assertion of jurisdiction, assuming it's correct, and of course we challenge the Commission's authority to impose the refund obligation at all on governmental entities, but assuming it has any authority, counsel pointed out that its assertion of jurisdiction was very narrow, limited to the specific facts, as he said, where the sellers sell into a single price auction spot market where everyone obtains the same price. Of course, what counsel said yesterday is what the Commission has said many times in its orders, seven times by my count, and what the Commission says again at page 87 and 88 of its brief in this case, where it was contesting the position of parties who said that the Commission's assertion of refund jurisdiction was too narrow. Defending that argument, here's what the Commission said, and I'm quoting at pages 87 to 88. This proceeding, since its inception, has been limited to California ISO and PX centralized market operations with parties on notice that only their sales in those markets were subject to refund. Under that theory, and particularly as applied to governmental entities, the Commission's assertion of a refund authority over bilateral transactions it makes no sense. It's completely inconsistent with the Commission's own assertion of a limited refund obligation. I would take in particular the case of, let me turn first to the OOM transactions. These were transactions that, by the Commission's own characterization, were not only bilateral and, by definition, out of the market. They were, as the Commission said, sales that could have even been made at cost-based rates. So they clearly weren't even market rates necessarily in that sense, let alone sales into a centralized single price auction spot market. The Commission, assuming the only real argument the Commission offers in response, and it's not what counsel said yesterday, but in its May 2003 order, it says, well, you know, yes, we said seven times before that it applies only to the centralized spot market, what we really have here is a sale made under the ISO tariff. Well, if you look at what the Commission said, and I'm looking at page 556 of the record excerpts, the Commission, in referring to the California ISO tariff, says that the ISO OOM transactions were, as I mentioned before, cost-based, and they said that because the OOM transactions were authorized by the Commission and operate according to our rules, such transactions involving governmental entities fall under the Commission's jurisdiction. Well, that argument can't be squared with the rest of what the Commission has said. What the Commission means by the transactions being authorized under the ISO tariff is that the ISO is authorized to make purchases. If we accept the argument that every time a jurisdictional entity adds a language to its tariff saying it can buy power from a governmental entity, well, and that when it does so, those sales become subject to the Commission's jurisdiction, it swallows entirely the governmental exemption that the Commission has said yesterday constitutes the only basis for asserting refund jurisdiction. With respect to sleeve transactions, that argument obviously applies to OOM and to sleeve transactions, but there's a second problem, actually a second and a third problem, with respect to sleeves transactions. The second problem is that when we raised this argument about the centralized spot market, the Commission offered no response at all. That violates its fundamental duty to engage the arguments before it, so we're left to wonder whether it had any explanation or whether this is a closely guarded secret. But in any event, it's not offered a basis for this Court to sustain its ruling. There's a secondary argument here as well, and that deals with the nature of sleeve transactions. These were transactions that, as the Commission itself described, were transactions where you had an ISO lacking creditworthy status. It needed power. It used the sleeving parties, Los Angeles and Sacramento, for example, are the governmental petitioners, to purchase power from someone otherwise unwilling to deal directly with the ISO. And that party then charged its cost, or at most a markup, according to the Commission, intended to compensate the selling or the sleeving party for the risk of dealing with a non-credit-worthy entity. In fact, Los Angeles and SMUD still haven't been paid. So there was this risk. The ISO said in those circumstances, don't penalize these people and impose a refund obligation on them for helping us out. If this problem happens again, they won't help us the next time.
Is this leave challenge with respect solely to the governmental utilities?
I believe another private party has filed an intervener's brief raising the sleeves issue as well. So I think our argument would apply to them as well, at least this particular argument, and that is that the Commission had an obligation to consider whether it would make sense to impose a refund obligation on entities performing this function where it would be counterproductive. Their failure even to address that issue was arbitrary and capricious. Let me turn next to the issue of multi-day sales. Again, there are two levels of concern. The multi-day sales were also bilateral transactions, and the Commission had ruled that some of these transactions were not, in fact, multi-day in nature. Even if that determination were correct, they were nonetheless bilaterally negotiated and not part of the centralized spot market, so they would not be subject to refund under the grounds I've just articulated. But beyond that, there was this problem. The petitioners had argued to the commission that in defining what is a multi-day sale, and the commission had said multi-day sales should not be subject to refund. We said that what the commission's own precedent and what California law provided was that the mutual intent of the parties should govern the characterization of the transaction. The commission offered no response to that argument at all. So again, as with several other of the issues we've raised, we don't know what the commission's reasoning was, if it had any, for rejecting that contention. Let me turn last to the issue of emergency sales. The commission, and here I think it bears keeping in mind what emergency transactions were. The Secretary of Energy, in a series of orders starting in 2000 and going into February of 2001, had declared emergencies in an effort to assist the ISO, who faced creditworthy problems, the same types that we talked about in the Sleeting context. And what it said was, we're going to order otherwise unwilling sellers to sell power to the ISO if the ISO makes a certification to us, the Department of Energy, that it needs this power, and if the seller otherwise wouldn't impair its ability to serve its own customers. If those conditions are met, then there'll be an emergency sale under 202C. The ISO developed no procedures for identifying what was or was not an emergency transaction, and the petitioners, Modesto and the state water contractors, said to the commission, look, we made some of these sales into the centralized spot market. There were no real ways to know what was or wasn't an emergency transaction, and there was nothing in the orders of the secretary that would have suggested that these transactions would have been disqualified from emergency status simply because we sold into the centralized spot market. We did this to help the ISO. The orders of the Secretary of Energy had nothing to do with refund obligations. They had everything to do with helping the ISO out. And in these circumstances, we said there was no basis for the commission to narrow the emergency exemption to the refund obligation to exclude sales made into the centralized spot market. The commission, again, offered no response to this concern that was raised directly with it. Its argument on brief is that we didn't raise this issue on rehearing. But again, I think, as our reply brief pointed out, we did. And if you look at the record, joint record at, bear with me just a second, 362 and 370, for example, you'll see that it was directly raised. I see that I have some time remaining, Your Honor. We've briefed other issues, but we're prepared to rest on those. And unless the court has other questions for me.
Thank you, counsel. You've actually reserved some time for rebuttal, so that's a first.
It's a first for me, too, Your Honor.
We know all of your time is short, so we tried not to interrupt you. This would be our normal course. Mr. Lane?
Thank you. Nobody
likes what FERC's doing, eh?
Depends. It depends on what issue it is. Everybody likes what we're doing.
Yeah, that's true.
You just stay seated and people join and leave you, depending
right.
on my argument.
I'm just a beacon of certainty in this case. Let me address the what I like to call the issues, because it's so nice to say it instead of out of market. The first time that the commission raised this, contrary to what was brought out this morning, was on page 7 of the joint. We call it the JA and the D.C. Circuit. I can't get out of that, but I guess here we call it the JER. And that's in our first order, where we noted that the OOM transactions involve what the commission calls a must-buy situation. The OOM, the ISO's tariff, not only allows the ISO to make these OOM transactions, but requires it to do so when it's necessary for reliability. In other words, the ISO is in a situation where the grid is in danger of being blacked out or having rolling blackouts or otherwise not being able to provide full service, so it declares an emergency in some situations. Because the ISO needs, and this is happening, and this is happening in what's called the real-time market, which is, as its name implies, it's happening in real time. That people, in other words, people forecast even in the day ahead of or hour ahead market what their load will be, and as the load changes in real time, the ISO has to respond to that. So the OOM transactions become a must-buy situation because the sellers know that the ISO has to make these transactions to provide reliability. And that was stated in the first order, and that became the rationale throughout as to why these transactions were ultimately included in the range of transactions that would be mitigated in the refund proceeding.
What's the date of that order?
The August 23rd?
It's the first order. I don't recall. I think it's...
Well, it's important because...
Okay, let me get mine.
What they're saying is whatever you said there wasn't sufficient notice, and it wasn't until you got into the July order that
right.
you detailed...
It's the first order... and it's, if you just turn to page 7, if you have it, Judge McCowan, it's in the top left-hand paragraph. It's a continuation paragraph from page 6, but if you look at the last sentence, I'm just going to try to move through this quickly, you'll see that it's just reading the last phrase, the ISO is in a must-buy situation. And that's
so you're saying that by saying that OOM calls are made, the suppliers know it's a must-buy situation, that that's noticed that those will be included in the auction market, the auction market proceeding.
And in addition to that, yes, exactly. And in addition to that,
well, how do you respond? This is jumping ahead, but then how do you respond to the argument that FERC did not make any express findings concerning the just and reasonableness with respect to the out-of-market transactions? The express findings argument.
The express findings yes. and the OOM transaction.
Yes.
I think. All right. Well, there's. Let me explain what the Commission did there because there's a little bit of, miscommunication here. What the Commission did in the OOM transaction in the non-emergency, because these two things work the same way, and I think it's the same question for non-emergency, Judge Thomas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Commission said, look, we are going to look at all transactions, all OOM transactions and all non-emergency transactions, and we're going to use this MMCP method. Recall that there are thousands of transactions that we're dealing with. I don't even know how many, and just a large part of all the time it's taking is just to redo these transactions and to do an MMCP. So you think of the MMCP as kind of a benchmark against which you will judge whether prices are competitive or not competitive. It's a first test, if you will. And then those that are above the MMCP, as you heard, may be found to be unjust and unreasonable unless there are mitigating circumstances. This is no different from situations where the Commission has done in the natural gas side area rates or national rates when they did those kind of rate proceedings. with what was called, the courts have called, the safety valve issue, so that, in other words, you have so many situations that it's impossible to look at those individually in any kind of meaningful time fashion. So you make a first cut, and that's what the MMCP is designed to do, but you allow a safety valve situation so that individuals who have particular circumstances that may require some additional information to adjust their particular rates have an opportunity to do so. So we haven't decided that certain rates are unjust and unreasonable. But what the Commission said, I think it's on 241, is that we're going to look at all these transactions. That does not mean that refunds will be due for all these transactions. So it's a way of administratively and efficiently looking at this issue at one time and making a first cut on what prices will further require additional review, and possibly, let's say no supplier comes in with any information, the simplest thing would be that all the prices above MMCP would be found to be unjust and unreasonable. But as you've heard, there's a lot of factual disputes about what is the MMCP, and so I'm sure you or the D.C. Circuit will get a chance to review all of those at some point in the future. But that is why we've made a first cut, if you will.
I take your point.
Okay. But ultimately, recall that the Commission was concerned, just to come back to the transactions and how they came into the ISO market to be resolved. The Commission was concerned that structurally that conditions were created that sellers could exercise market power, otherwise abuse the process. And in the must-buy situation, that was where the Commission found ultimately that was the largest problem. In addition, in the non-emergency situation, the Commission initially decided, I think this is on 127, said, look, in these non-emergency situations, we're not going to look at this because we've already put in place some cap relief if there was a stage one emergency, and there's just more supply in non-emergency situations. We're not expecting to see non-competitive prices during those situations. But later at 269 to 270, the Commission said, oh, we thought this was what was going to happen, but we've got some complaints that the prices in non-emergency hours have been shown to be above what we would expect in a competitive situation. So we're going to do the same thing that we did with the UMAN that I just explained. We're going to measure those against the MMCP. Again, the Commission didn't find that refunds would be due in all periods. What it said was we're going to measure all periods, and only those that are above the MMCP will require further review. And as a first cut, those would be the ones where we consider there's the most potential for abuse.
My question on notice is, if you look at the first order, it makes a statement that...
Could you give me a page?
Yes. I'm looking at ER007. You know, these orders are included in different parties. So I'm looking at the August 23rd order. What you referenced before is the following paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, calls are made. Suppliers realize that ISO is in a must-buy situation. My question is that statement in and of itself sufficient notice that those transactions are subject to refund? You compare that with the statement made in the July 25th order, which is ER 182, where the commission then says essentially the same kind of statement. Both of these kinds of purchases are made, spot market purchases are made in order to procure resources necessary to operate the grid. Therefore, we clarify that the spot market OOM transactions are subject to refund and subject to the hourly mitigated price. I guess my question is why this clarification was necessary if, in fact, that first statement is sufficient notice?
Well, a lot of things we think is a lot of things that we think are sufficient notice, parties do not, and so things can be clarified. What the issue of notice here is whether the way that I view it is that the commission indicated there was a must-buy situation that was going to be a place where there was a great potential for abuse, and then ultimately it included those more clearly in the clarification.
Maybe I'm not being clear in my question.
So you need a clarification.
Is the statement, I need a clarification from you, or I'm going to give you a clarification. You can respond to it. The statement made by the commission is that this is a must-buy situation. But the commission doesn't then say, and therefore there will be refunds, that these are subject to refunds. Is there some other analogous situation you can point to where, by identifying the nature of the transaction, that the party should have fairly known that that was also subject to a refund? So because I'm trying to link the refund notice to the statement that the commission made.
Sounds like dicta to me, I guess, to put it another way.
Your Honor, I all I can say is people interpret these orders in different ways.
Do you think in fairness that they should be interpreted more strictly against the commission in terms of providing notice to parties of what their refund obligations will be?
I think, in my view, they should be decided just the opposite way, that we should be given, more restrictive, less restrictive. In other words, that
you want more power.
No, that we want more. If we've fairly characterized that this is a situation that we don't want people. In other words, if we think that these types of sales may be involved, we don't want people to come back 6 months later and say, "Oh, gee, well, you did mention it, and you did say it was a must-buy situation, but we want this to be restricted because, you know, you clarified it later." I think what we'd rather say is, yes, we did clarify it, and maybe it wasn't all that clear, but it isn't like it wasn't in there at all. And so that's the kind of, I don't think it's power as much as just, we're dealing with situations, this was an unprecedented situation in a new type of market. We didn't have that much experience with market-based rates. The situation was changing rapidly. There's a lot of pressure. We need some slack to try to get these things going in a way that ultimately will prove the most beneficial to customers.
Do you want to address the refund effective date issues?
I think the refund effective date issue relies on petitioners' view that because the commission denied the specific remedy of the price cap, that ergo the commission had to institute a separate complaint proceeding, and therefore that complaint proceeding doesn't start until 60 days from basically the Federal Register notice. The commission did not deny the complaint. The complaint stayed in effect. The complaint fairly stated in substance that refunds stated the circumstances under which refunds would be could be ordered, and the commission did not deny that, and therefore the institution of the proceeding relates back to the date of the complaint rather than the issue here is what initiated the proceeding, the complaint itself or the commission's action, which would be a Federal Register notice. And when we look at the substance of the complaint and see that it could involve refunds, in our view, it related back. And the fact that the commission picked August 29th the first time and then on rehearing when it was asked to look at it again, looked at it again and came back with, picked October 29th, and then when it came back, picked October 2nd, just shows that kind of shift, which that's why we have rehearing.
Is there a law to the effect that we should read these, something like the complaint, in a fairly broad and generous way?
I don't think it's any different from the way that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure would ask you to read a complaint that was brought in U.S. District Court.
I think we have your argument in hand.
Okay, thank you so much.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. I'm Stan Berman for the California Parties again. Let there be no doubt what this stage of the case is about. As I discussed earlier today, what's at stake in this case are $8 to $10 billion in overcharges to ratepayers in California. Of those $8 to $10 billion in overcharges, FERC has awarded relief that would provide $2 to $3 billion in relief. If what the sellers are seeking today were to succeed, that $2 to $3 billion will be gutted. They'll take away the first month of the period. Already most of the relief after January is gone. There weren't very many emergencies until December, only a few days in December and a few days in January. And during the emergencies, most of the high-priced sales were out of market. So if you look at what they've asked for, eliminating out of market, eliminating everything but emergencies, eliminating the first month, you're left with virtually nothing. And then, of course, there's yesterday when they tried to eliminate 30% of the relief. So the sum of what they're asking for is to gut the relief that FERC has requested. We, of course, think that we're entitled to expand that relief, not to gut it. I'll address the various issues that have been raised in turn. First, the refund effective date. There are several answers to the refund effective date. Answer number one, they have waived the jurisdiction on this issue. It's clear that they should have submitted their a rehearing of the November 1st, 2000 order. The November 1st, 2000 order sets that date, and it's a jurisdictional prerequisite under Section 313A of the Federal Power Act to seek review. They failed to do that, and the Kansas City's case that they cite deals with a situation in which an evidentiary determination concerning burdens of proof, and it wasn't clear until some later order that the burdens of proof changed something with respect to some piece of evidence. And a court ruled in that case that they didn't have to deal with the burdens of proof determination until it became apparent and applied to the evidence of the party at issue there. Here, the refund effective date was set in November 1st, 2000, and these parties did not seek rehearing of the November 1st, 2000 order. I'll note that other parties did. For example, Duke sought rehearing of that issue. Dynegy sought rehearing of that issue. We've settled with Duke and Dynegy, and they're not here today, thankfully. But the fact is that PowerX did not seek rehearing of that issue. That issue shouldn't be considered at all. I would also say, Your Honor, that with respect to whether that issue really matters, I would remind you that we're seeking relief not just under Section 206 of the Federal Power Act, but under Section 205 and 309 of the Federal Power Act, that even if you were to reset the refund effective date, our argument is that we get relief on October 1st, just as for October 2nd. And so it really doesn't matter all that much if you move it, if you accept our arguments relating to the fact that the complaint encompasses Section 205 and 309 relief. I want to note in that regard that FERC has made determinations about the impacts in the markets on prices of the acts of particular market participants. I'll note, for example, with respect to Enron, there have been factual findings about the impacts on the markets of Enron's behavior. And I'm turning now to FERC's June 25, 2003 order in docket ELO3-77, which is, and the page I'm looking at is in your ER at ER 473. And in ER 473, paragraph 56, FERC found in their conduct described above, the Enron power marketers engaged in behavior that undermines the functioning of the wholesale power market and our reliance on that market to ensure that rates are just and reasonable. Did you hear that? This undermines the functioning of the wholesale power market and our reliance on that market to ensure that rates are just and reasonable. FERC has found that the actions of at least certain market participants have undermined the rates that were at issue here. Whether or not we're under Section 206 or 205, whether or not we're before or after the refund effective date, we should get full relief from when the overcharges started. Finally, reviewing the plain language of the statute, the sellers fail. The statute, there's been an argument presented that the statute somehow only gives you relief under Section 206 relating to the exact issues that are identified in the complaint. But if you look at Section 206 of the Act, you'll see that it spells out that the party will raise the issues that it's seeking review of, but that refunds are then available back to the just and reasonable rate. That may not be what was raised in the complaint. If we simplify this to the old-fashioned case where people talked about numbers, if a buyer came in and argued that the rate should have been 5 cents, and FERC could find that the just and reasonable rate was 4 cents or 6 cents. But under the statute, they reset the rate to the just and reasonable rate as of the refund effective date. So there's no tie, there's no connection in the statute between the exact relief that was requested and the refund effective date. The refund effective date, it's just triggered 60 days after the complaint is filed or somewhere thereafter, you get relief from that period at the just and reasonable rate that FERC ultimately determines. I just want to note for the record that 60 days after the complaint was filed is October 1st, 2000. You might ask, why aren't we complaining that that the effective date isn't October 1st, 2000, even though that's 60 days after? The answer is that we failed to seek rehearing of the order setting the refund effective date at October 2nd, so we fatally waived that issue, just like PowerX.
Do you want to turn to the out-of-market transactions?
Yes, Your Honor. Turning to the out-of-market transactions, and I see the out-of-market transactions as being related to the emergency transaction issue. For me, they both have the common feature that the sellers are arguing that FERC didn't make specific findings or specific determinations to encompass or bring those particular transactions into this proceeding. My first answer to that is to turn back to a case that was before this court several years ago. That was INRI California Power Exchange at 245 F3rd. What happened in INRI California Power Exchange is that in the December 15, 2000 order, FERC said one of the problems in these markets is the operation of the California Power Exchange. We've decided that in order to fix the markets, we've got to kill the power exchange, or maybe not kill it, but we have to eliminate their rate schedules. So FERC eliminated their rate schedules, and the California Power Exchange sought relief from this court. In that case of 245 F3rd 1110, this court reviewed the history of the case up till then. Note that there were no refunds as of then, as that case was decided in roughly April of 2001, before FERC had issued its refund orders. But this court reviewed what FERC had done. This court found that noted FERC's conclusions that the electricity market structures and market rules had created significant flaws throughout the marketplace. It noted the broad findings that FERC had made concerning the problems in the California power markets and found that that justified the broadest relief, not just relief in particular hours as to particular transactions. They found that that required, that that allowed broad relief that utterly and completely revised and changed the way the power markets operated. And I'll note that on at page 1120, the court said, FERC's authority under Section 206 to remedy rules and structures adversely affecting market-based rates regimes cannot be read so narrowly. Indeed, as the Supreme Court held in the context of the Natural Gas Act, the counterpart to the FPA, agencies created to protect the public interest must be free within the ambit of their statutory authority to make the pragmatic adjustments which may be called for by particular circumstances. Surely the Commission's broad responsibilities, therefore, demand a generous construction of its statutory authority.
I have less problems untangling the party's argument on that one. Do you have anything to add on the notice issue beyond what FERC has provided?
Your Honor, I would add on the notice issue that the proceeding was characterized as, for example, the auction proceeding, and there's the question about whether the transactions are in it. This is not the auction proceeding. If you look at FERC's August 23rd order and look at all the other sections of that order, you'll see that it refers to transactions in the ISO and PX markets. Transactions are transactions in the ISO and PX markets. I think it's abundantly clear to everyone that all those transactions are governed by that. You don't need to look at just the fact that they mentioned transactions in one paragraph. The fact is that transactions are specific, as counsel for FERC pointed out, are required for the ISO so that they can procure power in the event of a reliability problem. They're specifically required, as we point out in our briefs, by Section 2.3.5.1.5 of the ISO tariff. It's a long
section. Could you say that again?
That's 2.3.5.1.5. Your Honor, the key point is that the ISO tariff requires those. Those are transactions in the ISO and PX markets. And since they're transactions in the ISO or PX markets, there's no mystery here. The complaints dealt with sales in the ISO and PX markets. These are transactions in the ISO and PX markets. This court in In Re Power Exchange has already found that FERC has made broad findings with respect to these markets that entitle FERC to exercise the broadest possible authority to reform and change and alter these markets. And I would again note the language of the statute. In the statute does not limit FERC to providing the relief that was requested by the complainant. If you look at Section 206, the statute provides that FERC will order whatever it determines to be just and reasonable. That may not be exactly what was requested by the complainant. I don't disagree that San Diego Gas and Electric did not originally request everything that's been at issue here, but that's not what the statute provides for. I'll note lots of people say that San Diego's request was denied. If you take the longer view, it's clear that what ultimately fixed these markets was the fact that FERC finally, about a year later, did enact price caps, except on a broader, wider basis than San Diego Gas and Electric had ever sought in the original complaint. That's what it took to finally fix the markets. I would also note, with respect to the notion that there haven't been particularized findings concerning out-of-market transactions or concerning emergency hours, the sellers would have us forget the fact that FERC made broad findings that there was the potential for unjust and unreasonable rates in all hours, and then it set for hearing the calculation of the benchmark price, the MMCP. And it also set for hearing the application of the MMCP to each and every transaction in each and every hour of the period. When it set that for hearing, that was a real hearing. That was a real hearing in front of an administrative law judge. It had discovery. It had cross-examination live. We're not talking about just paper submittals. We're talking about an honest-to-God real hearing that resulted in a lengthy findings that were issued December 12, 2002 that are contained in your in the joint ER. And the fact is that in that lengthy hearing, what the parties did was they presented evidence and they considered just what is the right benchmark price for each hour of the period. And then after finding the right benchmark price for each hour of the period, they tried out hearing the issue of how does that benchmark price compare in each hour to the transactions that were occurring in that hour. And they looked at they did that comparison for each hour. Only if the transaction prices were higher than the benchmark price were there any refunds. And then there was a calculation of refunds. And if someone didn't like the result, they could raise the issue at the hearing, and that was adjudicated in that hearing. So it's simply not true that there haven't been particularized findings. Your Honor, I would turn next, unless you have further questions on that, to the issue of sleeves. I guess what I'd say on sleeves is that it really needs to be broken down into a couple of different questions. First, I'll just to set the stage on what a sleeve is. I'll agree that the basic notion that people seem to be describing is a case where party A is not selling directly to the ISO, but they kind of go through a party B. And the party B is trying to avoid paying refunds. So the first question that we have to ask is, should there be refunds for the transaction at all? That to us is the most important question, because the answer is obviously yes if the prices were over the MMCP. That is, if party A wanted to sell at $1,000 a megawatt hour, which is 20 times the prices that are normally experienced in power markets, and then sold through Party B into the ISO. The fact is that there should be relief somehow to the ratepayers who had to pay $1,000 per megawatt hour. So question one is, should there be relief? And the answer is unambiguously, yes, there should be relief if the price was too much. Question two is, who should owe the relief? That is, should it be Party B, the one who that Party A kind of went through, or should it be Party A who owes the relief? And my answer to that is that that's not really part of this particular proceeding, because looking at whether it should be Party A or Party B really depends on the facts of each particular transaction.
My understanding is we're only determining whether it's in or out of the scope.
Well,
at this stage.
Well, that would be our position as well, Your Honor, and we would say that another stage will address the issue of should it be Party A or B that pays for it. The public entities have sought specific findings about those specific issues, and our supplemental brief that we filed said, well, if they're going to seek specific findings on specific transactions, we have some of our own that we were going to distinguish. Again, I don't think that that's an issue before you in this stage right now, because it really depends on the facts. Did Party B charge a markup? Well, that's a fact that matters. What other facts are there? Maybe there are some cases where both Party A and B should be jointly liable. We wouldn't mind that. In some cases, if Party A and B are jointly liable, as long as there are refunds. But it depends on the facts of each particular case. And then there may be some cases where Party B should get off and where it should be Party A that pays the refunds. But that depends on the facts. Your Honor, with respect to multi-day transactions, I'll just note that the only issues that have been raised in this stage relating to multi-day transactions concern the specifics of particular transactions, not the broad issue of multi-day transactions. That's an issue for phase two. I don't care to address it unless you have more questions for me. And the same is true of the issue of the so-called DOE or Section 202C transactions. Again, the issues that are presented by the public entities are relate to specific contracts and whether they fit within the context of and whether those specific contracts meet certain definitions or not. Again, we don't see that as a phase one issue. I guess I would just close out by saying that you know, having the sellers on that side and FERC on our side is helpful because it helps to remind us that we're not fighting FERC all the time. We've spent a lot of time in our briefs fighting FERC and criticizing FERC, but it's helpful to remember that the reason we're all here is because of the overcharges that were experienced in this marketplace, and that was caused by the sellers. And I would just, I guess, urge you and remind you that that one of the reasons for providing full and effective relief is to provide incentives to the sellers to actually follow the rules. And I think that in that light, I would like to give you a, a quote from an actual trader transcript that I think encapsulates this last point. That is, this was a transcript from Reliant. There are two traders talking caught on tape, and it's at page number ER4310. Person 2, hey, guys, you know when we might follow rules? If there's some sort of penalty. Person 1, that's right. Well, we think that is right. They might follow the rules if they have to pay. And we think that if they're going to be told in the future, if in the future we hope sellers to follow the rules, they're going to have to pay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. You can split your 5 minutes any way you want to. I think it's a total of 5.
I think we're separately have reserved time if with the court's indulgence.
Yes,
I think it is important to understand that we are not asking to get out of charges that are lawfully to be paid. We're asking the court to follow the statute. And the statute sets out very clear requisites of when the commission can order refunds and other relief. The commission misstates our argument with respect to the refund effective date. Our argument does not rest on them denying the San Diego complaint. It rests on the fact that the San Diego complaint does not give notice that refunds are a remedy. If you look at the legislative history of the 1988 changes that brought this amendment to 206, it is absolutely clear that notice is the sine qua non of the amendment. And you can't have notice if a party files a complaint that doesn't comply with Rule 206, which says you specifically have to set forth the relief. With respect to waiver, if you accept Mr. Berman's argument, you will be bringing yourself directly into conflict with the D.C. Circuit, which has expressly rejected the argument, and there is no case that they have cited saying that a person that was not a party to the proceeding doesn't have a right to file a rehearing when aggrieved by a subsequent order after having become a party. And there is a case, Villages of Chatham, at 662 F. 2nd, 23, the D.C. Circuit, 1981, which was subsequently adhered to in 347 F. 3rd, 964. Now, with respect to the issue, I'd like to make several points. First is the commission absolutely has an obligation under 206 to make a finding that rates are unjust and unreasonable. There's nothing in what the commission has argued here or in their supporting interveners to show what that finding is. High prices alone are not a finding of unjust and unreasonable in light of the market conditions that were going on with scarcity and high demand and supply. The commission now has changed its theory in argument to suggest that the mitigated market clearing price somehow serves now two functions. Its first function that was explained by the commission's orders was this is what the just and reasonable rate is going to be going forward. Now what they're saying is it's a screen to determine going backward what was an unjust and unreasonable rate. As a matter of law, Judge McEwen, you asked on the non-emergency hours part, is this an issue of factors and an issue of law? It is an issue of law to the extent that what the commission is asking for is for the MMCP to be the proxy, the dividing line between what is just and what is unjust. That is not what the commission said in its orders it was intending to do. They never set forth what a finding for out-of-market transactions as to what would be covered under the out-of-market transactions. Now, with respect to notice, the passage that you alluded to, Judge McKeown, doesn't say anything about out-of-market transactions being subject to refunds. It says the ISO has committed egregious errors in its use of out-of-market transactions, and it says, in an effort to address this problem, we direct the ISO to stop doing it. It doesn't say, as the Commission did in July 25th, nearly 10 months or 11 months later, that we're going to make these subject to refund. And, in fact, it would be illogical and irrational economically for the sellers here, if they knew that those transactions would be subject to refund, to engage in them. They would simply take their power and sell it somewhere else. The fact that the Commission directed the ISO not to engage in certain transactions cannot equate and be the requisite notice that those transactions, if the ISO violates the Commission's directive, are going to be subject to refunds. The two simply do not equate. Now, the last point that I'd like to make on the non-emergency hours is that the transactions that we are talking about in non-emergency hours do encompass the out-of-market sales. It is a broader category, but the same absence of any finding is fatal to that series of transactions as well. The Commission is required under Section 206B to make a finding of unjust and unreasonable, and the statute further goes on to say the Commission or the complaining party has the burden of proof. By Mr. Lane's statement here that we haven't figured out yet what is unjust and unreasonable because we haven't applied the MMCP, is a concession that they have not carried the burden of proof. Thank you.
I have just a couple of brief points to make. FERC has not responded to our arguments, but counsel for the California parties has raised two particular issues that I want to address very briefly. One is the suggestion that because the Commission has broad authority to fashion a remedy, it can go beyond what remedy the complainant has asked for. Irrespective of the validity of that argument, the fact is that the Commission's relief is constrained as with respect to the parties who are respondents. And the complaint by San Diego was directed at entities, sellers with market-based rate schedules. And even where – I'm not simply talking about where they refer to public utilities. And you could make the argument, well, maybe they meant all utilities. But they talked about sellers with – market-based rate schedules. Governmental entities don't have, and in fact, FERC has denied them the authority to file market-based rate schedules. So the complaint couldn't have applied to them. Let me respond second to the argument that we should wait with respect to sleeve transactions to another phase of this proceeding. As the petitioners read the Commission's argument or orders, we understand that they've imposed a refund obligation with respect to sleeving parties. And this, what this means, and it's the reason why the ISO itself opposed a refund remedy as applied to sleeving parties, is suppose we had made a purchase for $100 and then included a markup to reflect the risk of dealing with a non-creditworthy party, so we sold it for $105 to the ISO. And then the Commission determined that the reasonable clearing price was $80, we'd be stuck with a refund that exceeded even the premium that we had charged just to cover the market risk. There's a reason why we've asked the court, assuming beyond the issue of whether they could reach sleeving transactions for governmental entities, whether it made sense to impose a refund obligation, the equities of doing so. As I mentioned, the Commission offered no response to that argument at all, and we'd urge the Court to address that issue now and not at a later phase.
I take it your argument, though, is really limited to addressing sleeving issues on a categorical basis and not any particular transactions.
That's right, and I forgot to mention, Your Honor, Judge McKeown, with respect to your question about whether private entities had raised this issue, the party I'd forgotten to mention, I knew there was one, but it was El Paso Merchant Services, and they had filed an intervener's brief supporting the argument we have made.
Thank you.
Unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you. That concludes the arguments this morning. I want to thank all of you for it. It's been very helpful. Obviously, we've imposed some time constraints, which were onerous, and you managed to summarize your arguments and articulate them very well within that. We thank all of you for that. I'd like to thank all the parties here for their cooperation with the court in organizing this particular phase of the litigation. As I did yesterday, I want to recognize people from our staff who've just done a marvelous job of assisting with Nicole Benson and Lisa Evans. Would you stand, please? And Cecilia Dennis could not join us today, but she's spent also untold hours on that. All of you have dealt with our staff. You should know that they have our complete confidence, and we appreciate greatly their efforts in this. With that, the case just heard will be submitted. We will take an approximately 10-minute break and then return for a session to answer questions from the law students, and you're welcome to stay or not. We will not allow them to ask questions about this, the arguments today. Well, they can ask them, but we won't answer them. And we greatly appreciate the briefing and cooperation among counsel and the presentations.
All rise. This court, for this session, stands adjourned.